Good morning, Your Honors. Christopher Aberley for Mr. Randall Mason. The first issue in this case is relates to the fact that the district court failed to advise the defendant of his rights to counsel as required by Rule 11, that right being the right to be represented by counsel and, if necessary, have the court appoint counsel at trial and at every other stage of the proceeding. Now, the error is important in this case insofar as the court failed to advise Mr. Mason of his conditional right to appointed trial counsel.
Now, hadn't Mr. Mason have been advised of that right, and we know that because he signed a statement saying he knew of that right?
Well, in this case, he did sign a statement that said he had a right to counsel and to appointed counsel if necessary. Now, this right was in the plea agreement. This plea agreement was drafted in anticipation of his giving his plea, which he tried to do three times. The right did not mention the right to counsel at a trial. And number two, when the man went to the plea hearing, the court usually goes over these plea agreements and says, do you understand them? The first thing he said was, Your Honor, I didn't understand the plea. So
this is a separate one-page document that specifically says he has a right to counsel and one would be appointed for him if he needed one.
Correct.
And it wasn't limited to in association with the plea, was it?
It wasn't limited, but it also did not mention as I said, this was made in preparation for him going into that courtroom and tendering a guilty plea, not to going to trial.
But he had this for over a month, didn't he? It wasn't just seconds before he went into the courtroom, and so
he signed it. I believe a little over a month before the plea hearing.
What is your best authority that we should allow him to avoid his signed document in this regard and not hold him to it?
Well, the authority, it's not so much authority in this case. I mean, we have a very similar case, the one I cited from the Ninth Circuit. But the unusual thing that you have in this case is against the backdrop of that statement, that signed statement, you have several indications, affirmative indications in this record that Mr. Mason, in fact, did not understand that he had that right. The principal one is he goes to his second plea hearing and says, Judge, I'm not really guilty of this crime. It wasn't my fault. I haven't had my side of the story told. Well, why don't you then don't plead guilty, the judge says. And he says, but I can't afford a long trial. Now, that's a fair indication, we believe, that he did not understand that his right to appointed counsel extended to a trial. Furthermore, you know, it's not clear that he understood that even, you know, what it meant for him to be financially eligible, because he had several reasons to think he was stuck with this attorney. First of all, his attorney had moved to withdraw prior to the plea. It was denied. He was twice told during the second plea hearing and the third plea hearing that if he went to trial, he'd be represented by Mr. Williams, his retained attorney. So the record seems to show that he really, truly did not know that this right extended. And the record also shows, by the way, very, very affirmatively, that in fact, whether he realized it or not, he was quite qualified financially for appointed counsel. I mean, this whole crime was based on the fact that he ran out of money. He stopped taking a salary. He was trying to save his business and keep his employees. You've got a PSR that says he has zero assets, a negative income. You have the fact that he said, I can't afford a long trial. And you also have the fact that the judge, when he finally did do a financial assessment, he appointed counsel. He appointed me to represent him on appeal. And you also have, on top of all that, affirmative evidence in this record that he would not have pleaded guilty had he been properly advised. Again, I go back to that statement. You know, he's telling the judge fairly, you could say fairly directly that, Judge, I didn't commit this crime. I shouldn't have let it happen, but I didn't commit this crime. Well, don't go to trial. I mean, don't plead guilty. I can't afford a long trial. That suggests that if he knew he could afford a long trial, he would not have pleaded guilty. And this is a rare event. I mean, usually the defendant is advised at the initial hearing. He wasn't in this case, as the minute entry shows. The defendant is usually has appointed counsel, so he understands that when he goes to trial, if he chooses to go to trial, he will be represented by appointed counsel. Defendants are frequently, second, third, fourth timers. This man has never been in trouble before in his life, so he's never had the experience of being represented by appointed counsel. I think you've got an error that's rare. I mean, that's probably common, but very, very rarely harmless, very rarely harmful. But I think here you have the perfect storm of unusual facts. And, of course, if we don't reverse the guilty plea, you still have the problem now with the sentencing. Because now you've got defendant moving, finally, he moves for appointed counsel after the guilty plea hearing. It's a timely motion, well before the issuance of the PSR, and it's based on his inability to pay promptly, is the term he used, his attorney. And he's concerned that is causing his attorney not to give his case the attention it merits. And the court denies this motion with no reasons.
If we are to agree with you on the sentencing part, assume arguendo, so we would remand for a new sentencing with an appointed counsel, is that the relief you seek?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have to show that your client was harmed in the initial sentencing, that there were errors or any kind of thing that was overlooked, or is it just an automatic do-over since he was allegedly deprived of counsel of his choice?
Our first level, our primary argument is that he doesn't have to show harm, because the deprivation of the right to counsel is not subject to harmless error, and we believe that this qualifies. Gideon versus Wainwright says you have a right to appointed counsel; can't be denied. There's a right to, if it's denied, you get a reversal. You have the right. He had the right to fire his attorney and proceed pro se. If that's denied, automatic reversal. He had the right to hire his own substitute private attorney. If that's denied, harmless. There's no showing of harm required. I think it's an easy extension to take that here to a man who wants to get rid of retained counsel, is entitled to appointed counsel. He ought to be able to have that based on a motion that's timely, a motion that granting it does not affect the orderly proceedings of the court. That's our argument for no showing of harm. But we think that even if you don't go to that level, you have a sufficient showing of harm here just based on the fact that you've got an attorney who's essentially compromised by a client who's not paying him ably. And, that just sets up a conflict.
Can you point to some things that, you know, they didn't object to the PSR, or that there's something wrong with the way the sentencing unfolded?
Well, not specifically, but, you know, the sentencing hearing was a very involved proceeding, particularly because the result of the sentencing was to determine how much was the loss, and the loss determined how big the sentence is and how big the restitution was. And I think that if, you know, there was a lot of evidence and information and controversy there that a more zealous attorney could have perhaps, and again, I'm not pointing to specific prejudice because it's just, this record does not allow you to know that. What would another counsel have done? But we don't believe we have to show the Strickland type of prejudice here.
Is the Ninth Circuit case is on, you believe it's on all fours with this one?
Yes.
Is the First Circuit's gone the other way? Are there other circuits who have weighed in on this issue besides the Ninth and the First?
I don't believe so. My last check, I could not find that. And the question is, apparently it's a rare situation where you have addressing the retained counsel to appointed counsel situation. But this court should follow the majority opinion in Rivera-Corona because, as I said, if you have the constitutional right to get rid of your attorney and proceed pro se, what happens a week later when he says, Judge, I just can't do this by myself? I need
a
point.
Your position that at the guilty plea hearing, Mason does not need to establish that but for the action of the district court in appointing him court-appointed counsel, he would not have pleaded guilty. Do you take the position that he does not need to establish that in order to warrant reversal?
Well, back to issue one, we're arguing that had he been, and this is under the plain error standard of U.S. v. Johnson, but for the court's failure to make it clear to him that he had the right to at least apply for appointed counsel, which we know he would get, if he had been advised of that right, it is likely that that would have affected his decision to plead guilty. He would not have pleaded guilty. In fact, he would have asked for counsel. He would have had the attorney who he could afford to go through with this long trial.
But he signed a plea agreement. Didn't the plea agreement inform him of his right to court-appointed counsel?
Again, the plea agreement advised the defendant partially of a right. Number one, the right was partial. Number two, the right was my right to be represented by counsel of my choice, or if I cannot afford counsel, my right to be represented by court-appointed counsel at no cost to me. I would say you could rely on that most of the time, but not in this case. For the reasons that you have, number one, affirmative evidence in this guilty plea hearing and beyond that he really did not know he had that right. Number two, as I said, this document is prepared in preparation for a plea agreement, and nowhere in it does it say the right to trial and all other proceedings, as Rule 11 says. It does not track Rule 11. And number three, he goes into court and says, Your Honor, I don't understand the plea. So, you know, the notion that you can sign something that you don't understand is certainly not a foreign notion.
Let's talk about what he said in court. The judge says, this is at the plea hearing, are you satisfied with him as a lawyer? His response, yes, sir. Are you sure? Because tell me about why, how you came back to believing he was a good lawyer for you. This is after, obviously, he had evidenced some complaints about
yes.
his representation. His response, I never thought he wasn't a good lawyer. I just was confused. I mean, we came in with one plea agreement, and then I guess I got blindsided with another one.
Yes.
And I didn't quite understand the consequences. And we just really weren't communicating very well, the court, but you are now. Yes, sir. He sat down, and we talked at length. And I think I understand. Yes, sir. This does not sound like a defendant who doesn't understand what he's doing. This is very articulate communication, it seems to me, with
well,
the judge.
But
and so now you take the position that he didn't understand what was in the plea agreement, and he didn't understand what he was doing at the plea hearing, although he clearly and unmistakably says to the judge, I understand.
I understand what? He doesn't say what he understands. There's nothing in there that says, I understand that I have the right to court-appointed counsel at trial. In fact, he says, I don't, can't afford a long trial.
And so he now thinks this guy's a good lawyer because he doesn't know he can get a court-appointed lawyer?
Well, the question isn't whether he thinks he's a good lawyer. I mean, he goes back and forth before this and then after this. That doesn't seem to be the issue. And particularly if the man at this point in the proceedings believes he doesn't have a choice, Then I think that what he's simply doing is saying, Your Honor,
So when the judge says, and you are sure that you want to keep Mr. Williams, and he answers, yes, sir. He just said yes, sir, because he didn't understand what yes, sir meant?
No. What I'm saying is he said, yes, sir, since you won't let me have court-appointed counsel. Yes, sir, since I don't know that I have the right to court-appointed counsel. Yes, I don't want to drag this out anymore and have a fight over this attorney. You're not going to let me have a new one. You wouldn't let him go. You denied his motion to withdraw.
He didn't say any of that, though. And I guess you're saying he didn't.
Well, I'm not saying that
because he didn't know he could say it, or
I'm saying he didn't know he could say it because there's evidence in this record that he believed he couldn't say it. Is there any other questions? Thank you.
May it please the court. The defendant pled guilty on June 23rd, and the court actually accepted his guilty plea at that time. On June 3rd is when he made the comment that I can't afford a long trial. And it is obvious from the judge's response to defendant's statement that defendant did not say, but I can't afford a long trial. Defendant said, but I can't afford a long trial, because the judge said, I'm not sure how long the trial will be. So it is obvious that defendant's complaint was not that he couldn't afford a trial, but that he couldn't afford a long trial. And we know
that defendant what the difference
had health
is
issues.
That. Pardon? What's the difference in what you just said? I mean, it's more expensive to keep a lawyer for 3 weeks than it is for 2 days. I mean, I don't understand
this
distinction
defendant,
there.
This defendant has health issues, and he was under great stress. It is obvious from many of the things that went on during the time that he was pleading guilty and pending sentencing. So it is obvious that this man had serious physical health issues and also emotional and psychological health issues would cause him not to want to go through a trial. At all, that is long trial, and that it has nothing to do with his ability to afford or not afford to pay, because he doesn't mention that anywhere else or any other time. He never requested unambiguously or clearly that he or stated that he did not have the funds to afford a counsel.
Shouldn't the judge have gone through that with him?
On June 3rd, the judge recessed and said, we'll come back and do this, reset the guilty plea hearing at that time. This was June 3rd that made that comment.
No, I'm talking about specifically instructed him about his right to appointed counsel. Shouldn't the court have done, in a perfect world, wouldn't that have been what the judge was supposed to have done that didn't occur? Orally do that at one of these plea hearings.
On June 3rd, the judge said, let's tentatively set this for 10 o'clock on June 23rd. And then he said, later on, he said something to the effect of, that's a Wednesday. And if you're not going to go forward, let me know and we'll set it for trial. So the judge gave him the two options.
No, but it doesn't address his, if we don't agree with you that afford is really about health instead of money, and you can't tell from the record whether it is or not, then shouldn't the judge have, in the normal course of things, as they normally do and they do in the Rule 11 colloquy at the plea, shouldn't the judge have gone through and said that he had the right to appointed counsel at some point?
At this point,
orally.
The defendant had signed the statement of rights, understanding of rights. He had signed that document stating all of the rights that he acknowledged that he had and that he would be waiving if he pled guilty. He had already signed that. The judge was giving him 3 weeks to talk with his counsel about this. The defendant had already said that he was confused about the plea agreement. The judge was not going to get involved in perhaps negotiating or being accused of negotiating a plea agreement, so he just completely backed off and left it to defendant and his counsel.
But wouldn't that have taken place at the initial hearing? That this didn't take place in the original minute hearing, the minutes of the original hearing. This would have taken place at the first time that he appeared. He would have been advised of his right to appointed counsel, and he was not done so. Normally, you would have been advised of your right to appointed counsel. And saying you have a three-week break doesn't actually assuage that concern at all.
Well, Your Honor, this defendant had had retained counsel since before he was indicted, even. He appeared, his first appearance was with retained counsel. There was no indication whatsoever that this defendant was unable to retain counsel.
But doesn't everybody get that instruction normally, regardless of whether they're Mr. Stanford or whoever's rich who's on trial, don't they get that instruction that normally, and he didn't get that instruction? I know he later signed a document. I asked your opposing counsel about that. That's a problem for him. But wouldn't that normally have taken place at one of these preliminary things that he would have been advised of?
It would normally have taken place, Your Honor.
This is unusual that he was not advised of this, and it's a problem because he actually is very much in financial need.
Well, but no one knew that. And he did not
explain that. But if they do it normally for everybody, then he was deprived of something.
It is a usual procedure, yes, Your Honor. I will say that for sure. It is a normal procedure. Looking at Dominguez-Benitez, the Ninth Circuit had vacated a defendant's guilty plea precisely because defendant was not advised of this right to appointment of trial counsel if he could not afford to pay trial counsel. The Supreme Court reversed the Ninth Circuit decision. Though there are factors in Dominguez-Benitez which are not necessarily present in this case, there are many factors here which indicate that this defendant had no real desire to proceed to trial. And these include defendant was advised in writing and he signed the document, and the document makes the statement unlimited. It does not say for appointment of counsel for only a guilty plea. It is an unlimited statement that he could be appointed counsel or receive appointed counsel if he could not afford it. Also, defendant was represented at his guilty plea, and he acknowledged at the time of his guilty plea that he had resolved his communication difficulties with his counsel. Defendant did not indicate any desire to go to trial. He only indicated a reluctance to plead guilty, which resulted from a lack of understanding of the plea agreement. And it is apparent from some of the discussion in the different pleas agreements, or the different hearings, that he didn't understand the counts, and there were some changes made in the counts to which he was pleading guilty, and that caused some confusion for him. Also, the court offered defendant an opportunity to set it for trial and not to plead guilty, and defendant elected to plead guilty. And at his guilty plea, the court inquired specifically about his prior reluctance, and defendant assured the court that he understood what he was doing and wanted to proceed with his retained counsel. Reasons defendant did not want to go to trial: this would have been a trial on a 30-count indictment. It would have been long and stressful and would have put him in the public spotlight.
And expensive.
Pardon?
And expensive?
Yes, Your Honor, perhaps expensive. Defendant is in poor health. Trial would have been taxing on his physical health. Evidence of guilt was overwhelming. The likelihood of acquittal on all 30 counts was not likely. His guilty plea would mean a 3-level reduction in his offense level, something this defendant was most interested in because he expressed he did not want to go to jail. Moving on to the second issue, defendant's request for appointed counsel at sentencing did not claim that — this is in his letter of August, I believe it's August 3rd. That he wrote the letter to the court. This is after his guilty plea. He did not claim or support his indigency, but was merely — it was a request for different counsel. He was not working well with his counsel. He said that his counsel had was not spending as much time with him as he thought he should, and he surmised that this was because he was not paying his counsel timely. But he did not make a clear or unambiguous request based on indigency.
Why does he have to make a clear or unambiguous request?
Because he's got to show that he is indigent in order to get appointed counsel, and he has had retained counsel all of this time.
All along, the judge has known that there was an issue with affording a long trial. It's the same judge.
No, Your Honor, I disagree with that. I think that the judge, the one statement that he made in his June 3rd, the aborted guilty plea on June 3rd, was erased essentially by the commentary and the discussion that he had with the judge at his guilty plea, which was accepted.
What authority do you have for the proposition that he was required to not only assert his desire for appointed counsel, but also to assert his entitlement to indigency in the filing with the court? That was his burden to come forward with that initially, rather than to have the court discern that after a follow-up hearing or motion practice or something.
Defendant never really asked for it, saying that he couldn't afford counsel. He never really said that.
But is it your position that he had to say unequivocally that he could not afford counsel, or is it your position that he had to say unequivocally that he could not afford counsel and also demonstrate as an initial filing that he was entitled to it? I think you have that second plus factor in your briefing.
In Rivera Corona, the court specifically said that it was an unambiguous request, a clear request, and that was essentially what the court based its decision on. That is different here. There is no clear and unambiguous request for appointed counsel because I'm indigent. In Rivera Corona, the defendant said, I can't afford to pay the $5,000 to keep this attorney, and then he also said, I'm not getting along with him and I'm afraid of him. None of that was present here.
Where is the authority that it has to be unequivocal? What authority do you cite for that proposition?
Your Honor, I cannot recall the specific case right now. I believe I made the statement in my brief that it does have to be unequivocal.
Well, that's to proceed pro se because you're waiving an important constitutional right in that case, our case Brown v. Wainwright. But that is not the situation here. He's not trying to proceed pro se and thus waive a right, and so it has to be unequivocal. Where does it say that he has to be unequivocal?
If he is asking for the courts do not automatically appoint counsel to someone unless they do not have counsel, and then they will appoint counsel for an indigent defendant. But they do fill out a financial form that establishes that they are entitled to appointed counsel.
Right, when they're given the form. That once the inquiry is triggered, then they fill out the form and the judge decides whether they're entitled to it.
Correct.
But the inquiry is triggered now, and so he should have been presented with the chance to fill out the form, shouldn't he have?
Your Honor, because he had retained counsel with him and did not clearly state that he could no longer afford his counsel, he never said that.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out where
it was not triggered.
Okay, I'm trying to figure out where that requirement is that he has to clearly state. He said that he can't work with his counsel, that he thinks his counsel's not helping him because he can't pay his bills. Shouldn't that ding, 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 he's not paying his bills, and so he needs new counsel?
Pleaded guilty, Your Honor. At that point, he was convicted.
Right, but
so
there's a separate.
So he's talking about sentencing.
Right, and there's a step, and he's saying he's not getting good representation in association with the sentencing. This was in context of the sentencing.
Correct. This was in the context of the sentencing, and counsel had already mentioned in one of the motions that defendant had retained another counsel to assist with sentencing, with obtaining documents for the sentencing. So defendant has indicated that he has now two retained counsel. And defense counsel mentioned that there's nowhere else in the record that supports that statement by the defense attorney. It's because it wasn't challenged No one disputed that fact.
Is the position that you're advocating directly contrary to Rivera-Corona?
No, it is not.
Can you explain that? Because the concurrence in Rivera-Corona would seem to directly go to this.
Rivera-Corona was a clear and unambiguous request for appointment of counsel because he could not afford counsel and was afraid of counsel. In this case, neither of those very strong determinative factors are present. Dominguez-Benitez is probably a very strong case for us. And in fact, looking at the bottom line as to what defendant hopes to gain, the Supreme Court Justice Souter, speaking for the court, stated, based on the strength of the evidence against him, and I quote, "One can fairly ask a defendant seeking to withdraw his plea what he might ever have thought he could gain by going to trial." And that's the question we should ask this defendant. What can he gain by going to trial? He was advised of his right in a written document as opposed to in one of the preliminary guilty plea hearings.
Counsel, here's what I think the concern is. As regards to the guilty plea, I think your argument, frankly, is much more compelling than that of the defendant with regard to his appointment of counsel. It just seems to me, based on the colloquy with the judge, he understood what he was doing when he entered that plea, and he understood who his lawyer was when
he did. Right, Your Honor, and it's clear from the transcript.
Clear from the record. But between the plea and the sentencing hearing, he filed what I deem a request in the form of a letter to have the court appoint an attorney, and his words were, "Appoint an attorney who can help me." That's what he said in his letter. Now, I don't know what's unambiguous about appoint. I don't know what's unambiguous about and I don't know what's unambiguous about attorney. He says, "Appoint an attorney." He makes a request. And I want you to show me some case that would require him to, in conjunction with that request, demonstrate his financial eligibility to have a court-appointed counsel. Because I think that's what you're saying. He had to make an unambiguous request for counsel and simultaneously demonstrate that he was entitled to court-appointed counsel. I think his request for counsel is unambiguous. So unless there's something...
His request for counsel is unambiguous. He wanted appointment of counsel. Then he says, in that same letter, he says he's having, I think it's misgivings about having pled guilty even. So this person is ambiguous about many things. He's having difficulties communicating.
Well, you don't think it's unusual for somebody to have misgivings about anyone guilty plea?
No, Your Honor, I do not think that is unusual.
That doesn't negate an unambiguous request to have counsel appointed, does it?
Your Honor, the judge determined that this defendant was not entitled to appointed counsel at this point. He had retained counsel. He had two retained counsel working on his sentencing.
Did the judge actually do any of that analysis? What did the judge do in terms of determining that?
Your Honor, it is not clear in the record what went on with the judge. The judge simply denied the request or... I'm not sure. I think he may have even ignored it to some extent.
He didn't actually rule on it.
There was no hearing on it at all. No hearing. The government contends that this defendant pleaded guilty with full knowledge of what he was doing, fully understood what he was doing, and that this advice of the right to appointed counsel if he could not afford counsel was not a linchpin in his decision to plead guilty at all. This defendant did not have any real reasons to choose to go to trial. He wanted to plead guilty. He talked about not having told his side of the story. He got to tell his side of the story at the sentencing hearing, and the judge listened to it. It would not have negated his guilty plea at all. The government contends that the conviction should be affirmed, as should the sentencing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I don't think it plays in the analysis. I think that if you take the sentencing testimony and turn that into a trial, and you have the trier of fact believes this guy, then he's acquitted because he's blaming it all on his office worker, saying she's the one who forged these documents and did all these things. But Judge Graves, I'm going to give you one last pitch. When he goes in there and says, I understand everything I'm doing, if he doesn't know that there's something else that he has to understand, specifically that he has the right to appointed counsel at trial, then it doesn't mean much that he says, I know everything I'm doing and this is what I want to do. And all they have is the form. And the form would normally be good enough, except in this case, the form does not track Rule 11. It doesn't track Rule 11 in a very important way. It does not mention that the right extends to trial. And as I said, this was prepared in connection with his going into a plea, to tender a plea. And even that might not normally be enough, but given the other affirmative indications that he, in fact, did not understand that right, I think that in this case, that one form that he signed and was not reviewed at the plea hearing is not enough in this case.
I'm just assuming that we were to agree with you on the second point about the sentencing. I'm just troubled that it just seems like it's an empty victory. Because the sentencing was, you know, in the middle of the guideline range, it's they ran concurrently. There's not really anything wrong with the sentence. So he gets a do-over sentence whenever there's not really anything wrong with the sentence that you can argue today. You're not here to say that you believe it's not the standard. But what is to be gained?
Well,
as a practical matter.
It's really unclear in this case, but you can't say in this case he would get the same sentence because of all the factors that go into determining the sentence in this case.
He could get more,
but
he knows that apparently.
Just as he has the right to represent himself and really screw himself, if he has this right and he wants to exercise it, and he may this man believes that he's taken the fall for somebody. So, and how he wants to play that out, even if it's just at sentencing, is up to him.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. And want to thank Mr. Aberle, who's court appointed, for his work on behalf of his client. Thank you.